and welcome to Lunching with Lawyers. Lunching with Lawyers is brought to you by LorettaCrete.com. In this series of podcasts, Loretta explores the world of law graduates. She talks to lawyers, recent law graduates, and budding lawyers seeking alternatives or exploring how to get the jobs that they want. This podcast series is also for those thinking about pivoting or just wanting to do something different. So join Loretta for discussions with lawyers and law graduates about their careers and the paths they took to get to where they are. Let's explore what success in their profession looks like to them.
Hi everybody, welcome back to Lunching with Lawyers. Today I'm chatting to Steve Irvine, Principal Solicitor at Basic Rights Queensland. And with me to interview Steve is my colleague, Bryony Walters.
Hey.
Who knows Steve much better than I, having worked at Basic Rights Queensland. Welcome both to Lunching with Lawyers.
Thank you very much.
Even though it's a bit late in the afternoon.
It is. It's a bit past lunchtime, I think.
I want to point out that I taught Steve everything he knows.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Absolutely. If it wasn't for Bryony, this is a G program.
My goodness, Loretta. Just taking it to a whole nother level here.
Okay, that leaves me out of the conversation. Yeah, thanks very much. It was nice being here.
So what happened? Why? Why did Bry teach you everything that you know in the G-rated version?
In the G-rated version. Well, when I came to Basic Rights Queensland, I'm in my fifth year at Basic Rights Queensland, social security law was completely new to me.
Mm.
And so I actually came on board as the community legal education lawyer and the telephone advice lawyer. And Bryony taught me everything that you needed to know, but we're too afraid to ask.
Everything that you needed to know and never wanted to know.
Never wanted to know about social security law.
Isn't it funny? Because when we're a bit older, we realise what we don't know. I'm sure had you come to this position being a lawyer fresh out of university, you might have thought you knew lots more.
Oh, no, I can tell you that I came to that position straight out of university and I was acutely aware of how little I knew. I was advising off fact sheets.
Yeah, well, look, I was the same, not only here but anywhere, because I guess everybody's different, but I never go into a place thinking I know anything.
Mm.
So it's a lot easier to start from knowing nothing and then building up from there rather than embarrassing yourself with your fountain of legal knowledge. You know, in front of people who've been doing the job for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, we got distracted already, Bryony. I have this whole list of questions that I like to ask. Bryony, though, tells me that you weren't always a lawyer. So what were you before you decided to become a lawyer?
A spy.
Bryony likes to tell everybody I was a spy, but it's a dirty business, so I can't really discuss it. No, I was actually doing another degree an arts degree in modern Asian studies because I wanted to be an academic, funny enough.
Really?
Law happened.
Oh,
yeah,
what? Okay.
I know.
All right.
Yeah, prior to that I was I'm a technician by trade, so an electronics technician by trade, the trade that I learned when I was in the army. So I had a period of military service, and I was an electronics technician. And now that doesn't mean much today because, you know, I couldn't even fix a toaster. Not that I'm saying I could fix it out there. Yeah, so I spent nearly straight out of high school, I joined the Australian Army, and I was 13 years by the time I got out there.
Oh, really? So it was the Australian Army? Because you've got an accent.
That's
so
right.
Where's that from?
Yeah, it's a Scottish accent. So I was actually born in Scotland, and my family moved to Australia in 1971.
Mm.
Best move they ever made.
Yeah, well.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have scoffed. That's nice.
Yeah, it is. No, it's the best move they ever made. You know, it was. I'm not saying that they made really bad decisions. All of that. Well, they did. Like, look at it.
Oh,
but,
gosh.
Yeah, but it was a good move.
Mm.
You know, it was a good move for a lot of reasons. You know, yeah.
Again, you know. I started to say you know, and you're supposed to raise your eyebrows when
I didn't even do that by I didn't do that on purpose. I was just trying to pay attention to you while you spoke.
Well, I have done now a few interviews, and it's surprising how many migrants have been in that mix, and especially first generation migrants, either born here from a migrant parents or have come here in their lifetimes to Australia. And I would have to say a lot of them would have the same sort of thinking about that being the best decision that their parents ever made to come to Australia. And I don't think people realise how tough it probably was even in Europe and what a good life Australia represented in the 60s, 70s. I think, though, at that time, when my parents emigrated to Australia, it was still seen as a backwater. They came from Germany. They said, who would go there? And then they were all desperate to come here in the 80s and 90s, and the borders were closed.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
We moved to a place called Wyala in South Australia, which was...
Oh, really?
I still have fond memories of it. I haven't been back there since about 1979. But when people ask me where I come from, I always say Wyala. You know,
it's like the place where you identify with.
Yeah,
most
it's where
culturally.
I identify. Yeah, most culturally, yeah. And I guess. But in the span of my time living in Australia, it's really a small time I spent there, but it obviously had a great impact.
Did your parents stay in Wyala?
Well, my mother. I come from a single parent family.
Okay,
so there was my mother and my grandmother and myself who came to Australia. And my mother remarried. She now lives and still lives in Wollongong. She's been in Wollongong for...
Oh, the Gong.
The Gong. It's
That's
beautiful.
That's where I was born.
You were born in Wollongong. Yeah, funny, I sort of knew that. It was one thing I think we talked about. It. Maybe it must have been at a some CLE thing.
Maybe. Oh, gee, you've got a good memory. I can't remember what I had for breakfast yesterday.
Probably one of those standing at the stall ones down at Homeless Connect or something that when you speak. And because I remember when you said that, I remember.
Yeah.
The Wollongong part, yeah.
Because in my head I always associate you with Melbourne. Did you ever live there? I just doing that because you want to go to Melbourne?
No, I lived in Melbourne three times.
Three times?
Yeah. And again, it's probably the second place that, well, not really Brisbane is now, but Melbourne was quite often the place where I'd identify second as living because I'd spent so much time there.
Well, I guess there's home and there's where you're from.
Yeah,
because for me, like Brisbane is home, but Caboolture is where I'm from.
Yeah. And I don't know how that works in people's head. I don't know how it works in my head. You know, which, you know, look, there's probably people who would pay money 24/7 to find out, you know, what goes on in my head. But they
really?
No, they wouldn't pay money.
I'm sure. I was thinking, what sort of people do you know?
Well, actually, funny you should say that.
Hey, Steve.
Yeah.
Can I ask, do you like being a lawyer?
Do I like being a lawyer?
I mean, I guess you persisted at it for a little while now.
Yeah, not particularly. No. Oh, look, I guess with me it's been a love-hate relationship. I guess.
Oh, well, those are quite compelling.
Yeah, they are compelling. But, you know, I used to do a bit of tutoring at one of the universities, and I used to tutor pretty much first-year lawyers or first-year law students. And the first question I'd ask was, hands up, who wants to be a lawyer? And you'd be surprised that only about half of the class would put their hands up.
But why were they studying law then?
Well, I think it's the degree itself opens doors to other areas, you know. And I guess because of the I think it's that having a law degree gets you somewhere where you might want to go.
Oh, it's a nice piece of paper to tell you that you, you know. Yeah. Well, like in the absence of self-esteem, a law degree will do pretty, you know, will go a little bit of the way.
Yeah, or something like that.
It's true. You know, yeah. Probably I was saying the other day, I think that's one of the reasons why I did law, because it was a status thing.
Oh, yeah. I did my master's to convince myself that I was a worthwhile human being.
Yeah.
I mean, I got to the end and I figured out I'm not. So.
Yeah. What master's did you do?
I did master's at law.
Yeah. I thought it was some self-reflective sort of degree.
Because you interviewed Frank Garcia, and one of the, maybe the last course I did in my master's was his course at UQ, and I got 20 out of 20 for the reflective task. But it was like a real self-flagellating kind of, I grew up in Caboolture and what was me kind of task. Yeah, I didn't do quite as well on the actual research assignment, but what can you do?
What was the research assignment?
I used somebody's philosophical framework from international and development law space to say that there is a duty, or to argue that we could conceivably say that there's a duty to establish like basic minimum income on a global level, that all of the rich countries should pitch in and give money to the, I don't know.
Oh, it's like a universal basic income, but really universal.
I think Frank Garcia would have been quite interested in that.
He struck me as
somebody who's got very strong social justice.
I'm sure values. I only got a credit because I did a poor job of researching and writing it. But, you know, I'm a grown-up person allegedly living a allegedly grown-up life. It's tough to, you know, dig deep and get amazing grades all the time when you're, especially when you care about the job that you do.
Yeah, well, I did listen to something on the Happiness Lab the other day that talked about how bad grades are for actually encouraging people to learn.
Frank Garcia's class is the first class that I ever did in any degree where I actually read all of the readings. So to me, it felt like there was a big success in terms of actually engaging with the material in the course to learn stuff, rather than, because I've been very pragmatic over the years about engaging with learning in order to get grades, in order to achieve something else.
Well, that's exactly what they were saying, that they said when people are looking for grades, they're looking to get the grade, not to actually engage with the material. And once you're no longer being graded, that's when you start to really engage. When you think about it, the things that you've really learned over the years that you've had a passion for, you haven't been graded on it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I guess
there's pass fail in our social security law, because either the client gets the DSP or they don't.
They don't. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. DSP being the disability support pension.
Yeah. And that's
and that's what basic rights does, doesn't it?
Well, pass fail.
Well, helps people.
Yeah, no, it helps people with Centrelink issues, you know, social security issues. And, we do a lot of, we help a lot of people with, you know, disabilities. Pension problems, either losing it or trying to get it, you know, or payment rates and like that. That and debts would probably be your biggest major two areas. And then the rest of it just flows as it comes.
Dribs and drabs on the edges. But it's something predominantly a bit different, bit interesting.
Well, since I've been here, it's been, it's all interesting. It's and this is one of the parts about, do you like being a lawyer? But sometimes you feel so inadequate because you want to help people. Yeah, you just feel so inadequate.
Oh.
But with what you feel constrained.
Well, I was working in tenancy law when I think I figured out what I was really doing, and it was all because you couldn't. QCAT wouldn't generally let you stand up and advocate for the client. So you would go along with them and you would help them write the submissions and prepare and stuff like that. And then you would be there and you're sitting there going, I'm a lawyer, but actually I'm a social worker right now. Yeah. The value that I'm adding is enabling this person to actually, you know, step foot into the courtroom. And I'd sort of thought about that a few times when I'd been to hearings with people at the Social Services and Child Support Division when I was working at Basic Rights. And so I figured out that what I'm actually doing, or the value that I'm actually bringing in a CLC setting where the client doesn't have to pay money, there's two things, I think. The client doesn't have to do it on their own. They don't have to do it alone. especially when lots of them are, you know, disabled people, living with impairments of, you know, whatever sort. And also I figured out, I need to just not make it worse. If I don't make it worse, then they get the value of having somebody, you know, walk beside them while they do it. If I can be better than nothing, then that's a bonus.
Yeah.
Because I've spent all this time shitting on myself, you know, as a practitioner, as a lawyer, and then I was like, I don't have to compare myself to, you know, guns like Andrew Davison. I don't have to be Andrew Davison standard. I just need to be better than the client because they already have them. They just need something more.
Yeah.
So I'm fine, actually. If I'm better than nothing, then I'm fine.
Better than nothing. Right. You're better. I think you're better than nothing. Yeah,
It is true working in the social justice area where there's never enough resources to help all these people. And you know that so many people are going to fall through the cracks. And you can either burn yourself out or you can just think, I'll do the best job that I can for this particular client that I have in front of me. And hopefully you make a difference.
Yeah, yeah. And that's always the hope, that you're actually making a difference. And look, a lot of times you do. Like for what Bryony just described there.
Yeah.
Yes, you do. You make a difference, even if that's just being able to turn up.
Mm.
You know, it makes a difference to some people because usually, not only in the social security area, is it any other area, the community area that we work in, people were not, you know, they're so disenfranchised, they're not heard, you know, nobody, you know, they feel nobody's listening. And, you know, just to have somebody to listen to them for a start, and that's where the social work part comes in.
Especially when they think it's a lawyer listening to them, because for the first time, especially when you're poor, you have somebody listening to you that you place to a certain extent on a pedestal, and you think that there's something special. That often the things that people disclose to me are things that they've never disclosed to anyone else, because they see me as being in that position of authority and being able to help them. And they've never had that before.
See, this is why telephone-based servicing works for me, because if they saw me face-to-face, they'd realise how not special I am.
Well, I have often been said, you don't look like a lawyer.
Yeah, I mean, I've had that as well over the years. Mm. You don't talk like a lawyer. And I try very hard not to talk like a lawyer.
Absolutely.
I try very hard not to talk like a lawyer. And I always have done. One, I can't carry off when I do. You know?
I always wonder what image, though, they have in their head of what a lawyer looks like. It must be just American-based drama.
Oh, the fella from Suits.
I don't watch TV.
I've never seen Suits. We'll have to defer to your American TV.
I wouldn't necessarily.
It was Ally McBeal. When I was going to, everybody wanted to be Ally McBeal.
Mm.
I thought Ally McBeal for a long time was a male person.
I'm like three Ally McBeal duct taped together.
But everybody wanted to be Ally McBeal in the time. But I don't know. I don't watch a lot.
I thought of Ally McBeal when I was working for Basic Rights, and when Basic Rights was located in the Valley because of the unisex toilet.
Oh, right.
So I used to love using the unisex toilet because nobody else wanted to use it.
Was this a theme on one of the elements?
Ally McBeal had this unisex toilet. I guess I never watched Ally McBeal, so I'm just assuming that everybody turns up to work, makes out in the unisex toilet, and then at the end of the day they go to the bar with Vonda Shepherd singing, and then that's the end of the episode. But
And nothing happens in between.
No, well, maybe a bit of legal practice, I don't know. Just a smattering.
Maybe that's what prompted you to go to the law. You watch this Ally McBeal and you thought, look at it, looks like a
unisex toilet I'm in.
But I was going to actually ask you, why did you leave the army?
A mixture of sort of reasons. It wasn't just one particular reason. It's, I wanted my life to go in a different direction. I had a young family and I wanted to make sure that I stuck with my young family, basically, rather than...
Moving around.
Because I moved around probably every year. Hence living in Melbourne three times.
Oh, okay.
Living in Sydney twice and a couple of other places.
So Melbourne over Sydney.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I absolutely love Melbourne. Still love Melbourne. Because I had a break of 17 years from going to Melbourne.
Uh-huh.
And when I went there after that 17 years, it hadn't changed. It gotten a bit, it expanded a bit.
Yeah.
But I could still find my way around.
Yeah, of course.
You know, I could get lost in, and I could get lost in like Coburg and still find my way back. You know,
yeah,
it was still find my way to Fitzroy. It was not too easy to jump on a tram. You know, but,
I just love though the look of that harbour in Sydney. I just can't beat that.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. Oh, I like the inner western Sydney. I like going to all the pubs where it's girls wearing no makeup and you can drink beer and beer garden in the summer and it's not too hot.
They've got beer gardens in Melbourne.
No,
I think it's a new thing.
Yeah.
It's a new thing. It might take off.
Probably really positive associations from hanging out there with a very good friend.
Oh, yeah, fair enough.
It's just the story of it. How long were you at Prisoners Legal Service?
I think I calculated it the other day. I did once.
Oh, because you did two stints.
Did two stints. I stint for a year. And then I went away for a year, came back, and then spent 8 years there. So it would have been 9 years.
So really, you're only halfway through the amount of time you could potentially spend at Basic Rights.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah. I'm here for a long time, not a good time. nine years all up if you can count a break of a year.
Because that was. Because when you left, I think the first time that's when you did a bit of corporate work and then went to the RACQ.
Yeah.
Was that how depressing Prisoners Legal Service was? Like, it can be really challenging.
Yeah, no, I found it challenging. I didn't find it depressing. Mm. I found it, and even the second thing, even
well, depressing,
now,
I mean, like Bryony was saying, when you think, you know, the work that you do is a bit hopeless because you just sort of... There's so much work and it's so difficult. The clients are very difficult. The work's very difficult.
Well, the best clients I've ever had, without doubt, have been prisoners.
Mm.
It's straight off, you know. People ask me about... Because I've had a bit of family law and my belt, criminal law, a bit of corporate law under my belt too. And I find that the best, the easiest... clients to get on with have been prisoners.
And why is that?
I don't know. I just sort of I think you mentioned something about people disclosing things to you that they wouldn't disclose in normal circumstances, and prisoners are very much like that because they don't trust anybody, because usually any information they give to people is used against them.
Mm.
So they never lie. You know, it's not that they never lie, of course. they But I mean, it's not that in a lot of cases that they're telling deliberate lies. Mm. It's they're just telling you information that they think is enough for you that you need to know to go on. You know, and I had that conversation many times with, you know, you need to tell me everything, you know. And, so I just found them easy to work with, basically.
Yeah. And so why did you leave after the year and go off?
Oh, from there? Mm. I was still fairly new in law there, and I still wanted to try a few different areas. And it's what I encourage anybody who's new into the legal profession is, you know, you've got to try a few things before you know what it is that actually is going to keep you getting to work in the morning. And I find that with admin law, whether it's prisoners or whether it's social security law, you know, I've got this anti-government streak in me. Once it gets, you know, you think... I don't know really how to articulate it.
I've thought about this before, and I think that it's that there's other areas of law that where the idea of going really, really hard against the other side becomes ethically dubious at some point, like maybe in family law. But when it's your little client against the government, like I always say, like, you know, the government will keep, they'll be fine.
Yeah.
Like, it's like you don't have to, I think as a practitioner, it's like you don't have to spend a lot of time worrying about... Will the government be okay?
You mean you don't? I'd just like to say it's Bryony, just in case anybody's listening.
No, I'm sure I'm already on a list.
I think we're all on a list. It just
I think I'm on a list from hanging out with you.
Yeah, but that's it. I told you, don't hang around with me. You know, like, people...
I'm just not that cynical.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I suppose, but then again, you know, I've always been against banks. So, well, could be more, I think, on a high ground than that.
Yeah.
That's right.
I'm sure that your feelings about
payday lenders. But I have had, I did have a payday lender get up at a consultation and preach to us.
Oh, right.
About how he was doing his clients such a favour and what an outstanding citizen he was. And I thought, see, and I suppose this has always driven my legal thinking, or particularly in the last few years, because I've thought to myself, people always want to think that they're doing a good job. And if you can...
People will engage in so many complicated mental gymnastics in order to convince themselves that they're doing a good job. And I'm saying this right now and going, am I one of them?
Well, maybe we all are. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. I think that is true, that we all, to a certain extent... And if you can tap into that, and not in a negative way, not in a using sort of a way, but if you can make a person on the other side feel good about their job, I think you can get, and what they're doing and how they're helping your client, I do think that they will do more for your client than being this sort of
And so person. I actually think that when, and I appreciate that, you know, the matters that you're running would be at the first level of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, so in the main you don't actually have a lawyer on the other side, which is like an interesting thing to be thinking about. But for me, I've got that Centrelink lawyer on the other side. And I sometimes have to wonder whether or not the relationship of the other practitioner when they're working on the instructions of a government department is kind of maybe depersonalized in a way, versus when, you know, if it's family law and both of the lawyers have a client who's an actual person who has autonomy and dreams and aspirations and history and thoughts and motives, you know, maybe it's easier to just do the work and not think about... Maybe you're less invested in the outcome.
Yeah. When you're a government lawyer.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Because it's like, you know, government, I say to clients all the time, you know, like Centrelink doesn't have feelings. It's not going to be mad at you if you appeal.
Well, that's true about Centrelink.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not really sure that's true about, say, you know, government lawyers. I've had really...
I've had a variety.
Yeah, and just in case any of them are listening.
Of our huge audience.
Some of them I really like, to be clear.
I think a quite majority of them get it. You know what I mean? They get it. And I, in my experience, I don't... Not with
realise that the government lawyers, like the government has model litigant obligations, but banks won't.
Yeah, banks don't.
Even in those cases, I think that they do want to feel that they're doing good.
Oh, there's a PR interest, which I guess is kind of the interest in a way sitting behind model litigant obligations, arguably as well.
But the thing is, when you go and become a government lawyer, you're right, Steve. You know, well, a lot of raise your eyebrows.
That's Bryony. She doesn't like government lawyers. Nobody heard me, mate.
I love to call up a government lawyer and ask how their garden's doing and how the holiday with the wife was. Yeah. You know, that's nice stuff.
Maybe that's who I need to interview next. So we need to find a government lawyer, a good government lawyer that we could interview about their motives in, you know, going to the government. But I did interview a tax lawyer that works for the ATO and who's very strong on social justice issues and ethics. So I think when you do work for the government, often you do come from the right place because you have that sort of mentality about service to the public too.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
See, I think that, like, quite often they would have as much trouble with their clients as we may have with their clients.
Yes.
Because they're trying to do that. They're actually trying to separate themselves from their client, much like, yeah, you have to do. But I can find it, you know, very difficult, say, to get proper instructions from, say, a government agency. You know, and you must sort of tear your hair up
at times
when you're trying to tell them, you know, look, you want to sort of concede on this, or, you know, legally that's not correct, you know.
Or when I sometimes said, and they're fighting over a couple of $100s, and I'm thinking to myself, I mean, this is a model litigant issue, but, you know, just because they want to have like a little win, it's almost like the department wants to have a little win, and you sort of, you think to yourself, the amount of time in going backwards and forwards on this issue, how much has it cost the department for the legal fees in running that, let alone...
Well, I think they do bring an amount of commerciality to the way that they'll deal with matters, but there's limitations
on
that.
Yeah.
But I can remember when I worked at Basic Rights Queensland, you would do some direct advocacy straight to Centrelink before the matter had progressed to an appeal, and so there was a little unit that you would often get in touch with, and you were talking to the same people all the time. You had like these interesting working relationships with them, even though they were on the other side. And I can remember saying something about how I thought the relationship was a bit complicated. I really liked this other person that we were working with all the time, and she said to me, I don't know if she was saying that she thought it was complicated or not complicated. But it's kind of like they're the other party, they're the other side, and we exist in this adversarial system. But also, because it's Centrelink, and you think about like what is Centrelink there for and what do they imagine that their mission is. And she said, we also have an interest in positive outcomes for the client.
Yes.
I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting, because it's like they're your enemy, quote unquote, but they're also like somebody that you're working with collaboratively to try and create an outcome for the client that's possible within the existing legislative framework.
And look, that can be the same at the private level as well.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, I did a fair bit of personal injury work, so I was at a lot of settlement conferences and mediations with other lawyers from other firms and other barristers. And, you know, there was only a few that I probably found objectionable. Or more than objectionable, but... On the whole, it's like you pointed out, you know, after the shots are fired, everybody goes away, and, you know. But it's like being in criminal law, like I remember a client saying to me, I don't want this, I went with this lawyer, but he seemed a bit friendly with the police prosecutor.
Seems,
and I said, no, that's
good,
part of,
though?
That's a good thing, you know, I mean, just trying to. Sort a few things out, or whatever it was, you know. But
this person was concerned that their lawyer would be colluding against
them. Talking to the police prosecutor. I had this barrister, he was talking to the police prosecutor, like they were mates or something, you know what I mean? They were mates.
Yes. But that's, you're more likely to get a better result, not a worse result.
Well, you would hope so anyway.
I think so.
Yeah.
And I think that's, well, again, I think that's because clients probably have watched too much American crime drama, where it's very much adversarial, even in their personal relationships between the defence and the prosecution on those crime matters. So.
Yeah.
I get it. It's really tough, you know, they're navigating a thing that they haven't navigated before. Who do they trust?
Yes. Oh, no, that's right. It's, yeah. I mean, but that's the whole point of it. Who gets the law? Who gets the justice system? You know, I mean, do we as lawyers get it? Do we get it?
When
am I going to get it?
I give advice to some client and they'll be like, oh, well, that's not what they told me at the counter at Centrelink.
Yeah, that's
I'll
right.
go, I don't give a damn what someone on the counter
But you get a lot of
Centrelink,
that, whether it's the counter of Centrelink or whether it was...
My mate down the street said I should get DSP.
I asked this police officer and he told me this, and I said, don't ask police officers about the law.
Rules. Don't take legal advice from cops.
Yeah.
Or somebody working on a counter at Centrelink.
Yeah.
To be clear, I've got much love for people working on the counter at Centrelink. Dad worked at Centrelink when I was growing up.
But there's people you shouldn't take. You should take advice from fools.
Well, I always find it interesting when you give people advice and then they tell you, well, that's not what such and such said. Yeah. And I said, well, are they a lawyer? And they go, no. And I go, well, why have you come to see me?
Yeah, if I'm feeling really, if I'm in a good place, I'm feeling really gentle, I'm doing a good job of being that, like, you know, the best version of myself and advice, I go, okay, so you've got conflicting advice from two different people and you have to make a choice about whose advice you prefer. Now, I'm hearing that you got advice from Johnny down the street and you've got advice from a lawyer who specializes in social security law. Now, you have to make a decision about whose advice you're going to prefer. And I don't have a vested interest. Myself, yeah. I'm here.
A lot of people go to the sort of patisserie to get the teeth removed, do you know what I mean?
I have this list of horrible things that I say in advices all the time. Yeah. And one of them is you don't order a Big Mac from Pizza Hut.
Oh, really? Yeah. I can't believe you say things like that. Do you say things like that, Steve?
I've probably said a few choice things, but I don't have any catchphrases.
Centrelink is like a Coke machine. If you put in a dollar, a Coke comes out. Do you think the Coke machine cares if you get a can of Coke? Okay, so Centrelink is like a Coke machine. So if you put in a claim for DSP and evidence that you meet the legislative requirements to be granted DSP, then a DSP will come out. But if you don't put in the evidence or you don't put in a claim, a DSP isn't going to come out. And that doesn't mean that they hate you or they're trying to stop you from getting the thing that you deserve. It's just a machine.
Actually, that's a really good way, because often in banking stuff that, you know, when clients go, but I've been a customer of this bank for 40 years and, you know, and why don't they care about me?
Because it's not a person.
That's right.
You're inappropriately anthropomorphizing a corporate body. Like maybe it's a person at law, but it's not a person. No. Yeah, it doesn't care about you.
Anyway, we're talking to Steve, not about ourselves.
Yeah, no, it's a great conversation. You know,
I think the thing is, because all three of us have been community lawyers at some stage, and I mean, right,
including right now,
as we speak.
Yeah. So, well, I think legal aid's a bit different.
I'm undercover at Legal Aid being a community lawyer.
Yeah. Mm. So I do think the community legal sector is very, well, political. I was going to ask you, what's it like working for a management committee? Because just for the audience, community legal centres are run usually by management committees, boards of management, and they can be very political. So what's your experience of working in that sort of a structure?
Actually, I have not. I mean, I had a fair bit to do with the management committee, PLS, and it was pretty much a mixed.
I'm going to go ahead and say that I'm on a management committee. I have no idea what I'm doing.
It was a good mixture of viewpoints, if you like.
Mm. Yeah, so you have never had, you know, a coup or something like that?
The AGM.
I've been involved in the stacked AGMs.
Yeah, I've heard of it happening in other sectors community sectoriness.
It's not, but not that so much I in CLC don't land. Care about it, but it seems like a very sort of.
Who,
I would rather just get out of there.
Who would
bother trying to stack an AGM
for a CLC? It's a lot of work, isn't it? Goodness gracious!
But it's not that. Why would you put your energy into that?
Some of the organisations can be extraordinarily political, and I remember this in particular because I was in Western Australia at the time and there was a stacked AGM, and as a result of that, the person who was successful in the coup was then later on endorsed by one of the political parties I think it was a federal seat. And so it is seen sometimes as a proving ground for, you know, whether you can do how well you play politics.
I was going to say political cutthroatery.
Yeah, cutthroatery, yes.
I'm trying to connect the dots here. Does this mean that if I'm on boards for long enough, then I get to be elected to some kind of public office?
Right. Yeah. It hasn't happened to me yet. And I've been on boards for 25 years.
It's a slow burn.
Each management committee will have a spy from each political party.
Have you been on a management committee?
No, I haven't. Been on the management committee, and I don't think
any gaps on your management committee, so I could join and boss you around.
Any gaps? I don't know. You'd have to ask the director.
The
director has more to do with the management committee than I do.
Different
at PLS when it was the role was the same, but so yeah, there's a separate role.
In basic rights, you're the principal lawyer, but you also have a director here.
Yes, we have a director. Yeah, and my job is pretty much the legal service. It's the running of the legal service.
Are you holding the risk?
Holding the risk. Can't you tell?
So it's a huge burden when you're working for Community Legal Centre, because, like you said, you hold the practicing certificate for the principal certificate for the practice.
And the level of compliance is really onerous, I think, as well. You know. But you're right, it is a burden. You're holding the practicing certificate for the practice.
Mm.
But again, it's the people that are working with you, is you need to have a lot of confidence in them. And that isn't a place where I've been, the two places where I've spent most time probably, PLS and here, where I've had, there hasn't been a person there I've had no confidence in. And it's the same here. I've been really, really lucky or really fortunate in the people that I've come across.
And so what sort of people are working in, basic rights? Like if you had to say what sort of a typical lawyer would look like that would be interested in working for Basic Rights or Community Legal Centre.
Well, you have to look at Bryony for a start, yeah.
It's just a place for me to go where I can have a Larry haircut.
Yeah. Well, so look, not everybody's the corporate type. Mm. I'm certainly not the corporate type.
Oh, yeah, I'm not.
I can't do it. Mm. Yeah, it's as simple as that. I've tried it, and I recommend people if they want to try it, they try it. I've tried it, failed miserably at it. Not my cup of tea at all.
I just don't have it in me to reconstruct myself into a different sort of person between 9 to 5. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Some people seem to do a really good job of that. I just don't. It's really nice to be in community sector where if you're an abject wreck, that to some extent is a strength because it helps you to relate to your clients and build rapport and...
I enjoy it. I once went for a job interview with a firm, and I'd been a lawyer for quite a big firm, and been a lawyer for a while, and they said to me, you won't be allowed to see any clients until you've been here for 4 years.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding. I I was my normal self, which you can't really be. I just laughed. and I thought, well, I'm not going to get off of that job anyway. But, yeah, but, there's a difference. I mean, here the type of lawyer who's here is, actually enjoys working with people,
And you sort of get thrown into the deep end too a bit.
You do anyway. It doesn't matter where you go and whether you're in the community sector, well, you're in one of the larger firms. You don't get much mollycoddling effects. Still a word you can use. I don't know.
That sounds like a great word.
Well, it is a great mollycoddling.
Bring back mollycoddling. I love mollycoddling. I love that word.
At work, we're bringing back carrying on like a pork chop.
Oh, yeah, I like that.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of that. Yeah. Talking about carrying on like
But all that great sort of Australian vernacular or slang is disappearing. I'm missing it. All of that type of stuff. I'm actually missing it. The language has changed so much. The language does change, but
everything changes, Steve.
Everything changes. look at me. I stand before you. But the type of lawyer that comes to the community, I guess. That there's all different types. There's the people who are battered and bruised from the corporate sector, from years of of actually maintaining whatever they try and maintain there. Mm. And there's those who start here with, you know, who know that lifestyle or that type of work's not for them. And probably a bit more less legalistic orientated, not knowledge-based. I'm not done with less knowledge. I've worked with some of the cleverest people. Some of the cleverest people I've come across, I've worked with in community legal centers and still do to this day. And I'm just in awe of them, you know. Mm. So it's not about,
But it's about knowledge. That practical application.
Yeah, it's about the practical application and I guess it's about the personality too.
Don't you love it when, like, a client will say, like, oh, well, if you work at a community legal center, are you a real lawyer?
Yeah.
I get that too. Yeah,
legal aid get that, and I hear it from people who've been to legal aid because actually working with as a preferred supplier with preferred suppliers, you could, especially in crime, you get that. Oh, I went to legal aid, but I needed to get a real lawyer, you know.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so you get that, you know. But let's go back to that. Everybody hates lawyers except their own, you know. You know, oh, but you're all right, mate. I hate lawyers, but you're okay.
Yeah. I must admit, I haven't heard that so much.
Yeah, I've heard.
Oh, I hate lawyers, but you're fine.
Yeah.
No, I get a bit of that.
Yeah. There's only one person I ever came across who just said, I hate lawyers, and I believed him. And so I stayed out his way.
I kind of respect the perspective, though. Like, I get it.
It wasn't so much what he said as how he looked.
All right.
See you, mate.
Not going to argue with you. Yeah,
bye.
All right.
Yeah. I'll pass on that one.
Yeah. But just about. But yeah, so, I mean, you do get a fair mixture of people in the community sector, as you know, the community legal sector. But I think the majority of people here actually think that, you know, the system is not very good. And so they want to make it.
So they want to make a difference.
They want to make, they actually want to make a difference to it's what Bryony was talking about earlier, making that difference to
being better than nothing.
Being better than nothing. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Helping people not have to do it on their own.
And a lot of times maybe in other areas you don't see that, you know. Admittedly in our area you sort of most of the time you're giving people bad news and you're not seeing any big massive victories and that can be sort of, you know, that can weigh on you a bit. But that's why you sort of, you live on the small victories, you know.
Yeah. For sure.
And because in a lot of cases doing social security work, you would be telling people bad news.
Pretty much.
What? Yeah. And when I first started working at BRQ, because Basic Rights Queensland was my first job out of uni, it was really tough for me to convince myself that my involvement was making any kind of difference, and so I decided that every time somebody that I was working with would have a win, I would just write it down on a post-it note so that I could look back and try and see something about what was going on. Was there any point to doing it? And I still do that. Every single person who gets a win, I write their name on the post-it note and I stick it to my computer. So I've got this list of everybody who got something and I write down what the win was.
Oh, that's such a nice thing. I should really start doing that.
Yeah.
Because I keep my compliments in a compliment folder, but I don't sort of keep my wins because...
I don't hang on to the compliments because it's such a strange one-sided relationship with such a substantial power imbalance that it's like, well, you know... I don't know.
Sometimes
I value the compliments when they come through, but...
And I mean, sometimes the clients are never going to... All they're ever going to do is say something to you. Like, it's the people who have more ability that are going to write something to you.
And so the people that I find the most meaning in assisting are the people who are the most difficult to engage with, who are the most unpleasant to engage with, because I used to fight with the old senior lawyer at Welfare Rights about this, because if clients were too tough or too rude or too difficult to deal with, he'd say, cut them loose, you know, like whatever. And I'm like, it might not be diagnosed, but I think that's actually like part of the vulnerability here, part of the reason that the person hasn't been able to, you know, move their matter forward effectively is because like a barrier for them is that they're quite unpleasant. And I'm not sure that any like quote unquote rational person would sit down and choose to present in that way if it means that they can't get the things that they need. So, yeah.
But this is a problem with the system, really, isn't it? Because we're so, you know, we're expected to produce some widgets, and those clients are going to take up all of the resources for a whole lot of widgets that we're supposed to be producing.
You show me the structure for measuring the widgets, and I'll show you how to game that system. You know, I'm a lawyer. You know, like the system of the place that you work in terms of establishing KPIs and showing that you're valuable to the organisation. There's different views about this. I'm very Capricorn about this as well, but that's just another layer of advocacy for you to navigate in order to keep on being here for the clients that you're working in service of.
Look, I agreed with you, Bryony, to a certain extent, but if they're using there's so few of us really in the community sector and at Legal Aid doing civil law, and you think to yourself, you're supposed to spread yourself so thin, and if one client takes up, you know, a quarter of your time for the year, how much time do you then have to devote to all that? How many people miss out because of their behaviour? So I can see the other lawyer's point of views too.
You just look to the ways that you can manage the clients in respect to that kind of stuff, I guess.
You know, I struggle with that.
Yeah.
I really struggle.
No, I know what you mean.
I think quite a few of us struggle with that.
Yeah.
That's right. And that's why you'll find, I don't know how the corporate world goes or... but with clients who come to the community legal sector, I mean, they get more than one goal usually, don't they? I listened to what you said, Bryony, and I know.
No, sorry, I just thought about how there's some corners of the sector that talk about frequent flyers.
Frequent flyers.
I was just thinking about how the last private law job that I had, I was supervised by a fella who is kind of incredible and is a barrister these days. And he said to me, he was the person who introduced me to the idea of the 80-20 principle. And he was like, you know, 20% of your clients will take up 80% of your time. I don't recall him telling me anything about how to deal with that after that, but I think having boundaries is really important because there'll be a bunch of clients who sometimes I think about service-seeking behaviours, quote-unquote. So, you know, if you – there's particular behaviours that people will present with to they've learnt that it's a way for them to get what they need from services.
Yeah, I mean, but you're always going to get it. It's like saying...
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, I guess you can say that. So you can... I think it's...
I don't want to frame it as a criticism because that, you know, everybody...
I don't think it is.
Yeah,
no, you know, I don't think it's every
people
sector.
People learn what works.
Yeah, and every sector, every area of society have... You know, people who seek things.
Squeaky wheels.
Squeaky wheels are the best thing because they get outcomes, and what they do is drive sector change. And sometimes I look at them and go, I wouldn't be bothered. I don't know why you spend all this time. But they do, they get outcomes, and you go, gee, that is a fantastic outcome. I just had one the other day, where I'd spoken to them many years ago, and I'd said that they didn't really have a case, and they just kept going and going and going and got their outcome.
Yeah. It's so humbling.
But then gave
it's
me
so
credit.
Humbling.
But then gave me credit
well,
for it.
Well, that's very gracious, isn't it?
So it was. But I thought to myself, you know, it's that doggedness that our clients sometimes have that get those outcomes that are just spectacular, and you don't have the time to pursue
that's
those.
Right, you don't have the time or the resources to pursue it. Yeah, that's right.
And sometimes to find that balance, because we're very susceptible to burnout in the community sector,
well,
I think.
And that is still a big problem in the sector, is this burnout. You know, this losing of resilience, and you know, it's very, very important that we always have that probably at the forefront of anything we do. and for especially for new people coming into the sector, it's very important to keep them.
Well, sometimes I wonder if it's like a self-selecting bias, that the kind of people who are attracted to the sector are the kind of people who actually have their own histories of trauma and might have, poorer boundaries on average. I'm obviously talking about myself right now. And so it's like, if you're really personally, emotionally invested in the work and the outcomes for the clients, it's really hard to set those boundaries.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. Everybody.
I don't think it's true of everybody. Yeah.
But I think we all come with our own sorts of perceptions. I wonder whether, one of the reasons I chose this area, chose to work in this area. I always thought that I wanted to be rich and work in the corporate sector.
I thought I wanted to be a family lawyer at Hopper Ganham.
Well, I wanted to be a family lawyer.
Oh, really? So yeah. How did you end up being how did you first get to the community legal centre sector? That's really, because you had done a few stints in private law firms.
Yeah, I was actually doing crime at the time. And I'd sort of had an interest in, from when I did my articles, I actually had to do a lot of prisoner files, PI files, and I would read through dozens and dozens of prisoner files. And then I saw the job advertised for prison legal service and I thought, yeah, and I applied for it and actually got it. And so that sort of, it was an area that, I'd be at the prisons anyway on Friday with every other lawyer at Arthur Gorey, seeing your client but actually doing another stage of it, even though it was PI, but getting to actually having an in-depth look at people's lives that people don't see and thinking, there's something more to this or there's something more to this person or, that's not being addressed or, And when the job came up with PLS, I thought, I'll jump.
And did you have much criticism about working for prisoners, in the community or amongst your friends? Or
You always get a couple of it depends who it is. There's a couple of barbed comments and, things like that. Oh, why do you want to do that?
And how did you respond?
I can't even remember. I just shrugged my shoulders. I let people be what they are. So if they've got a bias, sometimes I would go to great lengths to explain why, and access to justice and people's lives, and then you're only two. It's what we do here. You're only two steps away from the clients you're trying to deal with, and not a lot of people get that. Things like that.
So what are the two steps? Because I haven't heard about that.
Workplace injury. Just acquiring a disability. So many of the clients that we deal with are people who acquired a disability. It's really galling for them, I think, because from their perspective, they did all of the right things. They worked really hard. They paid their taxes, quote unquote. And then, things go wrong. And then they're being systematically disrespected and disregarded and debased. And that's
in the social security sector.
That's how the client feels.
But how do you explain that in the prisoner legal service sector? Because you just said you're only two steps away from perhaps being in that same situation.
People make bad choices. And people make bad choices for different reasons.
Everybody makes bad choices. Everybody commits crimes.
Whether they're
minor or less.
If I take say an example of women in prison, there's quite a lot of women in prison there for crimes of poverty. Stealing or being in possession of things, that's feeding the families. It's a part of society that nobody wants to look at.
Working in call centre at Legal Aid as a student, so many women who were being done for shoplift where they were putting food in the pram and get pulled up because they've hidden some extra food in the pram.
Or people taking the rap for other people because of the situation. Yeah. So they might get the kids taken away, things like that, So the people's stories don't really get much airtime because nobody's interested. Everybody is in prison is either the worst sexual offender or the worst murderer, or, you know. But there's a lot of people in prison for under 2 years, you know what I mean, for example, who've actually, you know, so what they, you know, I don't mean so what to dismiss the choices they've made, but it's that you can't really judge people's choices until you actually, you know, get a taste of what they've been through. And that's it's very difficult for, and myself included, but for most people, it's not a reality that they want to address, you know what I mean?
Oh, because the world is so complex, and it's easier and safer, I think, to grapple with the world as something that's flattened out into something a bit more simple.
Good and evil.
Yeah, good and evil. That's right.
If I can construct a reality where everybody who's in prison are people who deserve to be in prison, then that makes me feel safer because I'm a good person, and that will keep me safe from ending up in that position.
And there's a great myth about prisoners that every time you talk to a prisoner, they're not guilty, you know, which is not true. You get you know, one or two people who will maintain their innocence, and there's, you know, it's statistics have shown. I think it was at one stage 5% of people in prison are innocent of the crime they're there for, because the law's quite technical. Funny enough, you know, but people—that was one of the people. Oh, I suppose they all say they're not guilty, and I said no. Most of them put their hands up for what they have done. They take responsibility. It's what do we do now? You know, what happens when they leave?
How did they get to there?
How did they get to there? And what's going to happen when they leave? You know, and this is what politicians don't get either. You know, you can put as many people in prison as you want, but unless you're putting them in prison for the rest of their lives, I better not give them any ideas, for the rest of their lives for stealing chickens, you know, which is probably the next step, you know, they're going to be released back into the community. What do you then do, you know? I mean, most of those are going back into prison.
Going back to the communities where that sort of behaviour is accepted, you know.
Or just like the same conditions.
Yeah, the same conditions.
You know, behaviour was categorised as an offending behaviour.
I used to see it a lot with students, because I've worked a lot with students, both at PLS and here, and you get the same reaction here sometimes. People who have not been exposed to the things that we've been exposed to, or, you know, where our clients have been exposed to. When I say is they have that moment of clarity, and they go, it may be here, and then maybe, oh, maybe this person isn't a dull bludger.
I used to be so insufferable when I was supervising volunteers.
Oh, was that you, the
basic,
dull bludger?
Basic rights. No, because I had a list of articles that spoke to like those issues about, I guess, like situational stuff that leads to welfare dependence or poverty or all of that kind of stuff. So as soon as a volunteer started saying, you know, vaguely prejudicial things about the choices of the client group, I'd be setting them homework, like different articles that I was going to make them read before they came in for their next shift.
And it's so important. But having said that, those students, I think, were really brave, because knowing that about themselves and having those prejudices, they still wanted to come here and volunteer. So you'd already caught them. You're catching them. I think it's a really great thing if people volunteer in a community legal centre, because you hope that you can give them some sort of different perspective. Because a lot of people who do law are privileged.
You're not wrong.
You know, come from a privileged background. They don't represent what's out there in the community. So
I mean, I got to say that when I'm at UQ, or when I was at UQ when I was doing masters, I would see a lot of country road bags.
Is that a sort of a country road bag?
No, it's like a bag that you can get from Country Road that girls at private schools would have.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I was going to say.
This is a highly prejudicial comment on my part.
I think my pants are from Country Road.
Oh, goodness.
I don't shop there normally.
All right.
I don't shop there normally.
Fancy you are, community legal centre lawyer.
I usually wear jeans, but I put my best chinos on for this podcast.
Oh,
all right, okay.
Yeah, well, it's really made a difference.
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
I thought we've actually been speaking for quite a while, so I did want to ask you some questions just about your, because you did a double degree in majoring in Indonesian and Asian studies. So I wanted you to talk or say something in Indonesian for my Indonesian audience.
You have an Indonesian. I told you before we started that my spoken Indonesian is buruk. It's gone. It's,
all right. You know, well, very, just even know, if you say, well, yeah. Well, what's buruk? It means gone, is it?
Oh, yeah. How about I say, see, you've put me on the spot and I don't know, you know. Actually, any Indonesian when you meet for the first time usually ask you if you've eaten something. So the first is sudah makan. They used to say, have you eaten? You know, after you introduce yourself, they'll normally say, sudah makan.
So, well, I haven't eaten. Have what you are eaten? You offering?
Well, the thing is, my stomach's rumbling, but that's why
I haven't fed you.
I'm really interested in this now. If everybody's so motivated to ask me if I've eaten recently, I do want to go to
Indonesia. It's good to you know, but as far as speaking Indonesian, it's been a long, long time. You know? So, sudah lama berbicara in Indonesian, bahasa Indonesia.
I'm going to ask you some questions about CLCs because I do think that's really quite interesting. So what do you think is the best thing about working in the CLC sector? You've been here for 15 years, like across basic rights and prisoners.
The best thing? Mm. Well, it's although I said before about giving people bad news most of the time, there is a sort of a sense of not personal achievement, but not that that you're doing it for any sort of personal gain, but you're actually doing the right thing. Mm. You know, I think that's a big difference too. It's, you know, why do you do this? Because it makes me feel good. Well, it doesn't make me feel good, but it's the right thing to do.
Doesn't it?
I mean that in a general term. Yeah. You know, you're not here. There's not a lot you're going to do. It's getting back to the area where you don't get maybe a lot of the big victories that you're not on the news with. Well, I've got this client, $15 million or whatever.
No.
You know, but there's two things, and it gets down to that, you know. It's that sense of it's the right thing to do. It's people's access to justice, people's vulnerabilities, et cetera, et cetera, getting access to justice. The other thing too is being a lawyer in this environment, it's a lot more relaxed than it is, say, in the corporate world or even, you know, the smaller or medium firms. Is, you know, you for what you don't get in money, you make up in sort of lifestyle.
You know, and camaraderie.
Yeah, definitely camaraderie.
Not the competition.
There's actually little or no competition here, you know, that I've come across, you know. That it's only in my experience. I haven't seen it. And I'm saying getting to work with some of the, you know, the most incisive minds, I was going to say, but, you know.
Passionate minds.
The passion of people coming. I mean, we were talking about volunteers before. The passion that you see sometimes in volunteers. And like most people I know working in the CLC area have started by volunteering in a CLC.
Well, that's how I started.
Yeah. I volunteered back when basic rights was welfare rights. Yeah. That was my first gig.
An amazing amount of people that I know CLC world started volunteering. So it's a bit more relaxed. My biggest criticism of the CLC world now is becoming a bit too corporate. It feels to me sometimes that it's losing its grassroots appeal.
Oh, it's that marketization of the social services sector as well, I think.
Yeah.
And what can you do?
That's sad to see that. Mm. It's sad to see that. It's sad to see lawyers in the CLC world. And I mean, no disrespect to you people who wear suits and ties to come to work. I don't wear a suit and tie to come to work. But
it is true. But I think not that I used to dress that well when I was in CLC world, but I do think one of the things once somebody said to me, they said clients are worried when they go and see a CLC lawyer or legal aid lawyer because they do sort of think, are these real lawyers, right? And they are used to seeing people in suit and tie. And so are we selling our clients short sometimes if we're not wearing that because they think, well, you can't really represent me that well because the image that you're portraying to me is not of what a real lawyer would look like.
Mm. I think that may be true in some instances, but for me it's actually about communication and rapport with your clients. You know, that's it. If you ask me, if I've got 10 resumes on my desk that I'm going to employ someone, usually the first thing I'll look at is to see whether they've worked at, say, Coles or Macca's or somewhere.
Yeah, hospitality and retail.
Hospitality, retail, because then I can start with the premise that they probably know how to speak to people.
Yeah,
that's true.
And they know how to speak to people at, a grassroots level as well.
they've dealt with aggro people.
They've dealt with aggro people. Yeah. It's not.
They're not going to get scared.
They're not going to get. That's part of it.
True.
But they can communicate.
I never thought about that.
They can
communicate.
Absolutely. I have seen a lot of lawyers, and it's not fault of them, who've been in the profession for a long time, who have no communication skills.
Wow.
You know, and for me, it's a must in the community sector. So take away the suit. The suit, for me, provides a barrier. I know there has to be some detachment, and this is what I'm particularly bad at, and a lot of people in the sector are bad at, is that detachment. You know, and I guess that helps with the detachment.
That's some of the challenges, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. That sort of helps with the detachment at the certain time. I'm the lawyer, you're the client sort of thing as well, you know. But I don't think it's necessary.
I agree to a certain extent. But I certainly have found that's helped me a little bit more, probably to get that detachment, but also for clients to feel more calm. Well, sometimes it's hard. You build the rapport. You've got to be so careful to build the rapport, but at the same time not become too friendly. So you have to find that balance, because otherwise you want them to respect what you say. And if you're too friendly, they go, I don't know whether I should be listening to this person.
Yeah. You're shifting into like friend mode.
Yeah, sometimes I've had to say to people, look, as much as, because I'm a happy person, you know, always a little bit not so serious, I have to say, no, I've been doing this work for 25 years. I know what I'm talking about. You know, you must, if you do this, it will be good for you. Oh, so it is hard to find that balance, because like you said, clothing can build rapport, and if you feel too removed from them, they're not going. That's just one more barrier.
And I feel quite ambivalent about that thing, right, because I guess if you're interested in it, you're often thinking a lot about the power imbalance between you as a lawyer and the client, and you want to try and minimise that in some ways in order to allow the client the autonomy to make their own choices. But part of the role is for you to influence the client. And so if I find myself saying stuff about how long I've been in practice, I'm like, is this a moment where I'm trying to prove to the client that they should just do what I say, when actually maybe, you know, part of respecting somebody's autonomy is respecting the fact that they don't want to do what I say. And what does that mean?
Yeah, but I mean, I always do say to clients, you know, at the end of the day, it has to be your choice, you know. And I think that's always got to be at the forefront. But at the same time, you also want them to respect what it is that you've said to them. Like you gave that story about, would you, you know, are you going to listen to the person down the road or are you going to listen to the lawyer? It's your choice, but, you know, you are influencing them in that way.
Yeah.
Because you do think that this is that the path you are advocating for is in their best interest. You're not telling the client, you're not giving the client 10 options and saying, well, each option is equally as good as the other, because surely they're not.
Have the chicken or the fish, it'll be fine.
Sometimes one question that I really like to ask people is, because I'm quite interested in this, because I think Brian is brilliant at this.
Oh,
how has network?
You can answer it then.
How has, well, she's answered it before. She can.
God, I'm going to copy you.
All right.
How has networking assisted you? Networking and getting the roles that you've got and in advancing your career.
Networking as in like
any
career
sort of,
wise?
Yeah.
Well, what does networking
mean to you?
I think of networking more in terms of when I'm in a position actually, you know, working for the position I am there. As far as personal networking goes, I don't think I've actually – I can't think of a time where I've done it, really. Yeah, I'm pretty much a lone wolf like that when it came, you know. There's probably one or two instances where I've been able to call on people I know that way on a personal level, but, you know, I'm not a big networker myself personal-wise. I'm a big networker, say, organisation-wise, but personally-wise I'm not a big networker. So I don't know if that's the answer yet.
I mean, that's interesting. So it really, you don't think it's been an impediment to you doing well or having the career that you wanted when you haven't had a focus on networking, even in your personal relationships that you've built?
No, I don't think it's had a negative impact.
Yeah.
You know, I've only recently started that LinkedIn thing. You know, I only recently started that, but I don't think it's had a personal impact. You know, I guess I don't know really how to articulate it any better. It's just that I've never sort of. I guess it gets down to I've always wanted to do things on my own. You know?
Well, I think community sector and government sector are at pains to, at the very least, appear to be hiring people based on merits rather than on who they know.
Yeah.
So that's a thing. But also I think that your capacity to develop your merits will rest in some ways on the relationships that you foster. But, you know, like I take part in the Griffith University mentoring program, and I've got a new mentee, and she raised networking as something that she's interested in, so I've been thinking about it. And I think the thing that I like to do is to find community events that aren't networking events and to be involved in the community of practitioners. So do you go to, you know, the debate that somebody's holding at the Banco Court, or do you go to this other event that's about something else? You're not going to like a quote-unquote networking event, you're going to something like a community event that practitioners tend to go to, and do you go along, and when you're there, do you get to meet, you know, other workers who have shared values or shared interests, and do you build relationships in that way? And I think like how networking happens for me, that's how it really happens, that I you know, like we've got a colleague now, and I met her when she was working for a different service. We realized I met her in 2013 because she'd gone along to Homeless Connect, and I was there doing the stall for basic rights at Homeless Connect in like 2013, and then we started working collaboratively on client matters, and then I worked for the organization she was working for, and then she works where I'm working now.
Yes. So
that's but that's not what, you know, people say networking and you think like you go to a mixer that's like professionals and then everybody exchanges business cards. And
well, yeah, so I would need sort of networking for the socially awkward, if that, you know what I mean? Like, I think.
Well, I think we all probably think we're socially awkward.
Yeah.
I certainly do.
Yeah, I don't think I'm awkward. I think I make everybody else awkward.
Yeah, you make me awkward. That's dead right. I mean, you've got that now. Yeah. No, you're certainly not awkward.
I'm going to ask you one last question because we're
been too hard.
1 hour and 17 minutes.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Way too hard.
It's like a tough advice.
Yeah, it is. What's next?
All right, so the next question is, well, two questions, because I do really just want to touch on this briefly. Bryony tells me that outside of law, you love to bake.
I do. I'm a mad baker.
Yes.
I am a mad baker.
So what's the best thing? What's your specialty?
Oh, no, I make bread every week.
Oh, wow.
I make bread every week.
What sort of bread?
Just ordinary, everyday bread. Occasionally I branch out and make something else. I like making pastries and, you know, yeah.
And do you bring them here to work?
No, never. I'm too sensitive about criticism.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're usually all gone by the, you know. It's like I made three loaves yesterday, for example, because I had a day off. Mm. And, you know, yeah, they're gone. I think
already gone.
I think there's about that much left of them. Yeah.
Oh wow, Brian is just showing us the pictures of the bread.
Yeah, yeah, sure. That's actually
these
my
Japanese pastries.
Japanese pastry.
Oh
and,
wow,
Steve like curry pan. Yeah. And it's my attempt at 100% sober noodles, yeah, which went horribly wrong. But
I'm seeing a creme brulee here that I didn't know about. Yeah. It's one of my favourites. Yeah. I'm very excited.
I like making desserts, but yeah. I try not to because, you know, it means I have to walk extra kilometres and stuff like that. So that's actually a picture of me eating a crepe with ice cream. I didn't make that by myself. Yeah,
Wait, is this the pastry that you make later?
No, that was one that I. That's a bought one.
It's, yeah, but yeah. Is this what inspired you to make it later?
Oh yeah,
it's a picture of Steve holding what I can only imagine is like a koroke, like a Japanese croquette.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, nice one.
Yeah, so. I did at one stage make ciabatta every fortnight.
Oh wow.
But it was sourdough ciabatta, but it was so much work.
Yeah.
It was all done by hand and, you know, it's a lot of work.
Yeah,
but again,
a lot of
everybody loved it. Yeah, yeah. Of course it was just so
of course
much.
It is. It's better than anything delivered by in the shop.
Yeah.
And I do all my baking by hand.
Yeah.
And I try and do I like cooking in general. So I actually like to cook from scratch, everything by hand, and I try not to use machines. Except I had an avocado milkshake the other night, and I had to use the magic bullet Nutramix thing, because that's amazing. It just, you know, it turned out well. But cooking in general, but baking is, making bread.
Baking is like the science of cookery. Right?
I don't think it's science, I think it's magic. When you think about it, and then except sourdough, I actually have a confession to make that I kill sourdoughs. I've tried it for years, but always I've tried everything and it's still dying.
Actually, the aspirational version of myself is, you know, like the version of yourself that you wish that you could be is somebody who keeps a sourdough starter alive and makes sourdough.
Oh, I can keep it alive for a while, make a couple of loaves out of it, and then it just, I don't know what happens. I kill it. It's like gardening, I guess.
Oh.
You know, I don't garden because plants hate me. It's like that, you know. But I find away from this type of work, you've got to have something that gives you some focus other than this type of work.
Yeah.
And baking's good, or cooking in general, because you have to concentrate.
Otherwise, you're just community practice and lean cuisine.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I lived that life in 2010, and it was pretty grim. Mm.
And then the final question.
Oh, just one more.
One more, because we've got to get through this. What is some practical advice you would give to a young person wanting to pursue a career in the community legal sector?
Oh, the same advice I give to everyone is, you know, to guard their resilience, you know, to make sure that, you know, they look after themselves first, which is very, very important because of the big burnout rate, not just in the community sector, in law in general. It's a massive burnout rate, to look after themselves, to always, always look for jobs to apply for, not to get out of the community sector, but to actually, you know, because the sector is so volatile with funding that, you know, my example is I've been working 2 days to 4 days to 5 days. To, you know, it changes all the time. So you've got to have that plan B, if you like. Always have the plan B and pursue what you want to do as well. You know, have a crack at it.
Yeah,
you know, you got to have a goal. You've just got to have a goal. If you're in a place that you're not happy with, you need to. And this part of the profession I was reading the other day about educating yourself to do other things. I think young people coming into the law and the community should be doing that all of the time. You know, applying for jobs doesn't mean you say you have to take it.
Yeah.
You know, but it's good practice because one day you may have to do it for real. The same as going to interviews, you should do it and go interviews.
Somebody in the career service at Griffith University told me that their view was that even if you're happy in your job, you should apply for at least one job a year, because that's like a distinct skill set as applying for jobs.
Yeah.
So you want to keep that skill up.
I'll come and see you when I'm applying for a new job.
Well, I love helping other people with job applications.
Yeah. On that note, Steve. And Bryony, thank you so much. That was such an interesting conversation. I had so much fun.
Oh, good. Yeah, I'm glad.
Thank you, Loretta.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on Lunching with Lawyers. If you enjoyed this episode or have questions or comments for our guests, head to the show notes for this episode and click on the contact links below. If you have suggestions, ideas, or questions, or would even like to be part of this series, head to the Contact Us page on our website, www.loretacrete.com.